Our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Jamie Dengler. Jamie, it's good to see you.
Good to see you too, Eric. Thank you.
We are making a little bit of a quick transition here, which the listeners know about. We go from one guest to another very quickly. So, Jamie, the question that we start the show with is, who are you? And you can take it any way you want, or even not answer it.
Well, I think it's an important question to answer. I think we probably all struggle with that question: who exactly are we? Because as life proceeds, who we are changes and goes into many different directions. So I guess when I first hear that question, I think, well, first of all, I'm a mother, a wife, a sister, a friend to many mm-hmm. people.
Sure.
And that's the first thing that comes to mind.
You think of your relational connections.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Family, has always been very important. And I actually think about that a lot more. I have a lot more over the past few weeks because I just lost my mother who passed away at 91 after wow. leading an incredibly rich life. Yeah. But what happens now is the not reconstruction of the family, but the realignment of the family since she was kind of the center.
Sure.
In terms of those of us who live in different locations, where we congregated and got together.
She was truly the matriarch,
yeah.
the hub of the wheel.
Yes, and I've thought about that a lot. In fact, one of my cousins said that something to me recently to the effect that, people are looking to me to become that center in mm-hmm. terms of organizing mm-hmm. the family.
Yep.
And of course, as a thing, one of the things that has changed in many families is that across 2-3 generations, we don't all live in the same place. Whereas
right.
when my
right.
mother was my age, most of her relatives lived in the same place.
Right. Are you the oldest sibling?
No, I'm not. I'm actually the youngest.
Uh-huh.
I'm the youngest, but I guess for a lot of reasons, probably because I have lived away from where my mother and many of the family has been, and I've made a point to make sure that we stayed connected. I think people in the family may be thinking that I can do it.
You have the skill.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And as you say, it is a skill that is you really have to cultivate because
yeah.
we don't come by it easily. We
right.
have to work at it these days.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But I really value that. Yeah. And it's made me think about my identity more and differently now, that thinking more about the younger folks in the family
mm-hmm.
and how
mm-hmm.
they're going to see me and my role. And I think that's it's been actually comforting a little in terms of the loss of my mother, just to know that the family really wants the family to continue
right.
in terms of its extended
right.
groups.
Right, and in fact, her claim to eternity is partly carried on by your role.
Yeah,
you're taking
I hope
up
so.
Her role.
I hope so.
And that's a
yes.
very powerful place to be.
Yeah,
wow.
yeah.
And I and yeah.
yeah,
and the story today will be different than the story a year from now or 10 years
Probably.
From now or was 10 years before now, because this
exactly.
wouldn't have been on your radar screen so much.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm thinking about things differently than I did
right.
just
right.
a few years ago.
So there's kind of so how do you want to spin this song? You're the first song in your list, I'm assuming, is the song you wanted to start
okay.
with, which is If You Could Read My Mind.
Oh, yeah, I've just always loved the song. I love Gordon Lightfoot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I just love the mellowness of his sound and the way he gets us to think about relationships
mm-hmm.
and things going on around us.
Yeah, and
yeah.
the first release of this song was on an album that had a different title. The album
okay.
was titled Sit Down, Young Stranger.
Okay.
But this song became such a big hit that they re-released the album with the title of this song on it, If You Could Read My Mind.
Oh.
And Sit Down, Young Stranger was about a young man who had gone away and come back home to tell his parents that he wasn't going to fight in the war, he wasn't
oh.
going to do all this
mm-hmm.
stuff, and he was telling his parents where to get off, and they were having incredible conflict
mm-hmm.
over all of these relational things.
Mm-hmm.
And If You Could Read My Mind, well, we all know that song
okay.
because it made it
right.
a big hit for a long, long time. So we're going to go there now.
Okay,
thanks.
Great.
If read my mind, love. What a tale my thoughts could tell. Just like an old-time movie about a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark or a fortress strong, with chains upon my feet, you know that ghost is me. And I will never be set free as long as I'm a ghost you can't see. If I could read your mind, love, what a tale your thoughts could tell. Just like a paperback novel, the kind the drugstore sells. When you reach the part where the heartaches come, the hero would be me. The heroes often fail. And you won't read that book again, because the ending's just too hard to take. I'd walk away like a movie star who gets burned in a three-way script. Enter number two, a movie queen to play the scene of bringing all the good things out in me. But for now, love, let's be real. I never thought I could act this way. To say that I just don't get it. I don't know where we went wrong, but the feeling's gone and I just can't get it back. If you could read my mind, love, what a tale my thoughts could tell. Just like an old-time movie about a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark or a fortress strong, with chains upon my feet, the story's always in. If you read between the lines, you'll know that I'm just trying to understand that you laugh. I never thought I could feel this way, and I've got to say that I just don't get it. I don't know where we went wrong, but the feeling's gone and I just can't get it back.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and our guest on this hour is of the Made of Clay Report is Jamie Dengler. So, Jamie, one of the things that that we want to do on this show is to kind of hear about, you know, what experiences in your life have helped to kind of shape who you are and what you value, what you've come to understand is important. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I think I have to go back to my childhood. I grew up in a downstate community, Newburgh, New York, you know, in the 60s, generally. Uh-huh. I was a little kid in the 60s. And my parents had a little mom-and-pop grocery store, which was in a very interesting neighborhood, which was a mix of really poor people, kind of working people, and a few middle-class people. Multi-ethnic, and it—I did
and
a lot of.
Newburgh was kind of a river town in that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, and you know, very difficult life there, and I just observed a lot. I saw a lot of different kinds of people and had a lot of questions. Certainly, social class issues, which I certainly couldn't understand and articulate as social class and issues when I was very young, but I know how important the experience of just observing that as I was young was.
What did you see? What do you remember that you saw?
Yeah, well, you know, I remember seeing people who just really struggled and were really good people, mm-hmm. Worked really hard and didn't ever seem to get ahead. That mm-hmm. that was, I think, a message that I got very clearly. And then I saw others who were successful by the standards right. of their community. And I always wondered, well, what was keeping those folks back who were struggling?
Right. Yeah. Right. I worked at a grocery store when I was in, from 11 to 18 years mm-hmm. old, and sometimes you would see people come in with a real worried look on their face, mm-hmm. and we didn't have a food pantry, but mm-hmm. the thing was is that if you couldn't pay for your, and there were no food yeah. stamps at that point, mm-hmm. if you couldn't pay for your groceries, or if there was some question, the cashier would ask, you know, do you want to just sign the chit?
Yeah,
and it would go in a box, yep. and it would just be kept. And every once in a while, they would ask, "Or do you want to pay anything down, or can mm-hmm. you?" And you don't. Mm-hmm. And then every 6 months or a year, they would just decide how yes. much they were going to write off.
Yes,
and that was that. But what they noticed was, you know, how emaciated were the people? Mm-hmm. How anxious were they? What yep. were they? Just you see these things, the stress
right.
of life,
right? Exactly.
And it's unrelenting.
Exactly. And my parents had essentially the same system. It was a pad.
Uh-huh.
And the phrase was always, can you mark it down today? I'll never forget that. Can yeah. you mark it down? Yep, yeah, we'll mark
yeah.
it down.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so my right. mother kept a little pad.
That's a wonderful
and,
euphemism and,
yeah.
and also double entendre, mark
yes.
it down. It's,
yep.
And can you put it in the box today?
Yep,
can
exactly.
I sign it and put it in the box?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. And, you know, I saw, unfortunately, too, through seeing the people coming and going in the store and the conversations, mm-hmm. I saw the alcoholism and the, you know, the abuse, you know, that some of the kids and some of the women were experiencing. And of course, coming of age in the late 60s and 70s, I saw the drug problems really mm-hmm. hit the youth
right.
of the community and the alcoholism too. I remember a few years ago, my mother and I were sitting at her kitchen table having coffee, kind of going down the list of the kids that grew up in my neighborhood mm-hmm. around the same time that we were growing up and what had happened to them. And unfortunately, many of them died very young related to either car crashes or unknown things, but potentially related to their abuse of themselves.
Right, right, right,
yeah.
right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up in a similar environment. Mm-hmm. You may have heard me. Mm-hmm. 1 in 20 mm-hmm. wouldn't make it to the age of 20 because
right.
of drug or alcohol.
That's right.
That was probably the largest group. And sometimes there were suicides uh-huh. or implicit suicides in theirs. And sometimes uh-huh. there were two or three that we lost just because of bad health care.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have
that's
access.
Right.
You know, a couple died
that's
of meningitis, right. which was a bacterial version that mm-hmm. could have been treated even then.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they didn't have access.
That's right. And so. I could relate to that, too. Yeah. I don't know or recall of anybody having health insurance. It was
right.
always you paid cash.
Right.
Ran
up a bill.
You ran up a bill and then you paid,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
over time.
Yeah.
But still there probably were a lot of kids
yeah.
and families that didn't get health care.
So that awareness yeah. of those who have and those who don't and how people struggle and how some of the struggle mm-hmm. is imposed on people, how some of it's, you know, mm-hmm. bring it on yourself. it's a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. How has that affected who you are and how you live?
Well, I think, you know, aside from the profession I went into, which I love, which is teaching,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think I early on saw teaching as a way to connect with people, with
sure.
young people, and to learn more myself. You know, when you're a teacher, you yourself have to continue to learn and develop and to keep up with your field.
Yeah.
You know,
the one who learns the most
level.
Is often the teacher.
Yeah.
And what do you teach?
Yeah, I'm in sociology
mm-hmm.
At SUNY Cortland, and I have always been grateful that I was moved in that direction. And I have to say I went in that direction because when I got to college and took my first sociology course, it really started to help me articulate all of the things that I had experienced as a child, and being concerned with injustice and inequality mm-hmm. and things of that nature. So I was pulled in the direction of wanting to learn more mm-hmm. about that. So I think it affected me in terms of going into that profession. But I think also, aside from defining myself primarily in terms of my family and my friends and who I am in relation to those very important people, I guess I define myself as an activist. I have mm-hmm. been an activist my whole adult life, mm-hmm. you know, and involved in different kinds of struggles. But I think it all relates back to really developing a sense very early on as a child of not being comfortable mm-hmm. with injustices, inequalities, mm-hmm. just at a very basic level. It bothered me as a child. And so when I became older, I wanted to, you know, to act on that in some kind of a positive way.
Right. And yeah. What is, we've been through various cycles with activism mm-hmm. in this country, and in the 60s and 70s, I remember very effective activism, but I also that really engaged people. People they respected challenged mm-hmm. them, mm-hmm. and people changed when in those relationships. But when activism became more shrill and more at a mm-hmm. distance, mm-hmm. it ceased to have the same kind of impact, and it kind of drove the backlash mm-hmm. that we experienced in the 80s mm-hmm. and 90s. But we're coming out of that now yeah. in many ways. Mm-hmm. And what's mm-hmm. how has this affected your life, or how do you do activism?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure I can answer the question. Other than talking about what exactly I've been involved in, because there hasn't really been a planning of it. It's sometimes I just think I fell into things.
Yeah.
And I think my earliest activism, and when I use the term, I mean really working with other people at the community level to try to attack a problem, address mm-hmm. a problem, mm-hmm. was around environmental issues. And, I really began to be extremely concerned about environmental problems and issues, I'd say in the 80s, and, mm-hmm. you know, and that's when I my first son was born in the late 80s, but thinking mm-hmm. about having your own children and what kind of world you're bringing them into is a very powerful motivator.
What environmental issues got you started?
Well, what got me started was my own experience actually in Cortland back in the late 80s. I want to say 86, I think, was the beginning. We were struggling with a number of things, some water pollution issues mm-hmm. there. Groundwater contamination had occurred as a result of dumping on the grounds of the former Smith Corona plant. I was mm-hmm. heavily involved in that. And my well was one of the wells contaminated. So I had a direct experience that was, I was inclined, and I had begun to be concerned about environmental issues, but I had a direct experience, which then gave me, with my neighbors, mm-hmm. a very clear object or set of goal. We need to, as a community, respond to this and try to address it. And then we were struggling with the potential siting of a low-level radioactive waste dump in Cortland County and Allegheny County, some of the other areas New York State. I was heavily involved in that and moved on to other things as well. I spent about 10 years working with a community group in Cortland to clean up or to play a role as community representatives in the cleaning up of a federal Superfund site in mm-hmm. Cortland, the Rosen dump. So I have, I guess my environmental concerns led me to get involved in very specific local things that I just fell into because it had to be mm-hmm. approached. It had to be attacked and addressed.
And you felt that it had to be, and how did this network of people you care about in your life feel about your feeling?
Well, that's really interesting question, because I think as far as my family, my relatives, they are not inclined to be activists. They are more inclined to focus on, well, we just have to kind of get through our lives. I think they're all good people and they do good things in their lives, but they're not inclined to take on causes as they often. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I think I'm a bit of a curiosity to many of my family members for the level of involvement that I've had.
And how does that curiosity express itself? How do you experience their curiosity as opposed to their judgment or their mm-hmm. whatever?
Yeah, and actually I think there has been some judgment, not entirely good on the part of some of them, in the sense of feeling that I was, you know, somehow diverting my time and energy into things that were hopeless. You know, I think there's more cynicism. Mm-hmm. Then I just don't accept that, you know, I just won't accept that you cannot address issues and problems that need to be addressed.
Right. I guess. And what you just said, it mm-hmm. implies that cynicism is more damning mm-hmm. than having a long-standing fundamental principled conflict about
right.
something.
Right.
We live with conflicts our whole lives.
Right.
Most of our primary relationships are
right.
full of conflicts that
right.
we figure out how to dance with so that everybody kind of gets
right.
what they need. But when you're dismissed as kind of irrelevant or naive mm-hmm. or idealistic mm-hmm. or just, mm-hmm. you know, just mm-hmm. futile, mm-hmm. then that's mm-hmm. a real assault
that's
on
right.
the self.
That's right. Yeah.
But
yeah,
you haven't had a lot of that, though.
No, I just, you know, I guess one of the things I've learned too is that sometimes you do have to compartmentalize, you know, whether it's your family or mm-hmm. your close friends, you can sustain strong relationships with people who don't necessarily agree with what you find to be mm-hmm. the most important things for you to do in your life.
Right.
Yeah. For example, right now I'm heavily involved in the labor union movement, and most of my family are not supporters of unions. So I'm mm-hmm. constantly in the walking that line
right.
of trying to you know, maintain some kind of level of understanding on their part of why I'm so committed to the work that I'm doing.
And it would seem, in principle, that understand, even if they don't agree with you, they bless you to be among the coordinators of the next round of the family.
That's interesting.
I think, we fail. Respect isn't one we don't respect those whom we simply approve of.
Mm-hmm.
We tend
mm-hmm.
to respect those with whom we disagree,
mm-hmm.
and we know the fight's a good fight.
Yes. Yeah.
And so we would do better to be a society of respectful good fights, which
mm-hmm.
if we could learn how to do that, would
right.
be wonderful, than a society of dismissal.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's a really important thing to think about. Yeah.
So how do you try to engage them in not a conversion, but just awareness of what
mm-hmm.
matters to you in
mm-hmm.
the labor movement?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think sometimes, quite honestly, depending on exactly which family members are present, it's a subject that needs to be avoided. Because there is a strong opposition to what I find to be incredibly important right now in not only my life, but in our nation, in our state, and in our nation. But I think more generally, maybe I think my husband certainly probably has observed this, and we laugh about it. So I just kind of slide in little little
mm-hmm.
comments, you know, that are not meant to be snide, but when there are clear examples of why unions are important
mm-hmm.
or if there are things that are gained that we can attribute to the collective action of workers, if the time presents itself, I will make that connection. They respect that.
Right.
You know,
right.
You have to learn when you not to overdo it. I mean, I'm not one to try to convert people to think the way that I think. And I think I'm respected by my family members who don't agree with me for that. I don't bring it up. If the time is not appropriate, I don't go there, if you will.
What you've just described, there are little ways where you can raise things. Like when I talk about, you know, I began to work at age 11, and they paid me 75 cents an hour, which was 24 cents below the minimum wage. Yep. They got in trouble. I was too young. It was underpaid. Yep. And so, you know, anyway, all sorts of funny stuff happened.
Yep.
But the government was watching, which was kind of useful. And if that, and I made the minimum wage at the same time my mother, who after my father died had to go back to work, she was making the minimum wage as a nurse's aide. And we made the same amount of money. I would work 10, 20 hours a week during the school year, 25 and 60 during the summer. In the summers, I made more money than she did. And it was just kind of, but we both were making what would be $15 an hour now.
Yeah.
And when people hear that, even if they're rabidly anti-union, I said, my growing up in poverty and working for the minimum wage meant something completely different than what it does nowadays. And
this is
how far we have fallen.
That's right.
And even those who are most rabidly anti-union have to say that something's gone wrong here.
That's right. And I think, too, what I've learned is that at least the people in my immediate, community, the people I interact with most, whether it's family or friends, who are anti-union, they really they tend to be uninformed about exactly, and not having had any direct experience. So there's, you know, there's a lot of stereotypes, there are a lot of assumptions made. And I think sometimes you can really make headway in trying to get people at least to open up their minds and understand, you know, what you're committed to by giving them very simple, basic illustrations of, you know, in this case, you know, what a union has done in certain cases. And also what's happening nationally. Yeah, there's no question that the decline of labor unions and the successful attacks on labor unions have affected wages, working conditions for just across the board. There's no question about that.
Right. And we're coming at a time where that is a lever that can be pushed to powerful effect.
Yeah.
So what song should we go to next? You have Tangled Up in Blue and Forever Young and Desperado. I was thinking Tangled Up in Blue
because
tangled up in all sorts of stuff.
There you go.
Although not necessarily in the same sense that the song is about.
Yeah.
But anyway, so here we go. Bob Dylan's Tangled Up in Blue.
Morning, the sun was shining. I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red. Her folks, they said our lives together sure was gonna be rough. They never did like mama's homemade dress, papa's bank book wasn't big enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Lord knows I paid some dues getting through. Tangled up in blue. She was married when we first met, soon to be divorced. I helped her out of a jam, I guess, but I used a little too much force. We drove that car as far as we could, abandoned it out west. Split up on the docks at night, both agreeing it was best. And she turned around to look at me as I was walking away. I heard her say over my shoulder, we'll meet again someday on the avenue. Tangled up in blue. Job in the great north woods, working as a cook for a spell, but I never did like it all that much, and one day the axe just fell. So I drifted down to New Orleans, where I lucky with a being employed, working for a while on a fishing
boat right outside of Delacroix. But all the while I was alone, the past was close behind. I seen a lot of women, but she never escaped my mind. And I just grew tangled up in blue. She was working in a topless place, and I stopped in for a beer. I just kept looking at the side of her face in the spotlight so clear. Later on, when the crowd thinned out, I was just about to do the same. She was standing there in back of my chair. I said to me, don't I know your name? I muttered something underneath my breath. She studied the lines of my face. I must admit, felt a little uneasy when she bent down to tie the laces of my shoes. Trying to love in blue.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Jamie Dengler. Jamie? Jamie, so how have you changed over the years? What about life has, you know, mm-hmm. surprised you, or, you know, mm-hmm. how have things turned out different than you thought they might?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one way in which I've changed, and it may be something that a lot of people experience, it's just part of aging. You know, the more you learn and the more you see and do, the more you realize you don't know and you don't understand. And so I think I've changed in the sense of, you know, when you're younger, you feel like you know you've got a handle on it. I've got a handle on what's going on here.
It's knowable and it's almost all yes. known, and we're just going to take it the rest of the way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you realize just how complex you know, life is, and people are, and circumstances and situations are. So I like to think I've changed in a positive way in terms of understanding more about how much I need to listen to other people and to acknowledge that I don't have a handle on everything.
Right. How does change? How does that appreciation for complexity, the realization you need to listen, mm-hmm. Has that changed your relationships with people?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one way is, and certainly I think this manifests itself maybe more in work relationships than in family relationships, is that I think I'm more inclined to say, okay, let's take a step back and think about something, let's figure out what's the best way to proceed, rather than just, okay, let's just plunge ahead. You know, again, I've always been an activist, a doer. Let's just get in there and try to get something
done.
Yeah. Now, you know, I think you just learn more about, complexity, unintended consequences. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Striking that balance between, action and really a taking action, and but maybe needing to delay a little bit until right. you really try to get a strategizing thing. Mm-hmm. Spend a lot of time with colleagues at work, for example, right. Strategizing, trying to figure out what's the best way to approach a particular problem or goal that we have.
One of my guests made the observation that there was a time when he just, you know, he had an agenda for everything, mm-hmm. and now those agendas are so problematic. It's mm-hmm. more a matter of really cultivating the internal openness and mm-hmm. discipline. And mm-hmm. it's not so much about, I mean, it's partly about what you do out there, but it's mm-hmm. really about being the person in here that mm-hmm. is able to go with what needs right. to happen and discover it.
Yeah.
And I hear a little bit of that in what you're saying.
Yeah. I think the other thing too that is related in my mind is also, and I've always had this problem, you know, just, okay, it needs to be done, I'll just go do it. But you need, and especially this is true, especially in union work, you need to bring other people into collaborative work.
Right.
So sometimes that means stepping back and trying to mentor, trying to help someone else or another group of people develop their skills and confidence, et cetera. So again, I think that's a function of aging and experience, that you learn that it isn't all about, you know, okay, I need to do X, Y, or Z. It's about how can we help others. You know, so I guess I'm taking more of a role of the senior person in terms of work as well as in family, which is different. I mean, it's a different way to look at yourself.
Right. And it's also, it gives activism a certain measure of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the 60s and 70s, there was activism, but it didn't have a lot of wisdom, appreciation for the paradox, the hypocrisy, the things that inevitably come along. You made a statement that was really interesting to me, and that is that you see this more in your work and less in your family. And I'm wondering, what about that? Let's take the bigger picture. Let's take time to figure out what about that doesn't quite translate into family as much as it does into work.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe because of family, and again, I'm thinking about my extended family. Maybe part of it is just not living real close to everyone. Mm-hmm. It's not the day to day kind of interaction where you can build that. It's more, you know, the times that we have together, you know, need to be more about what they're doing. You know, I'm thinking about some of the younger members in the family, for example. Although that's different with my own kids. I have two sons who are, one, my youngest just turned 20 and my oldest is 27. And, you know, that's a different kind of relationship where as a parent, you're trying to, although I try, my kids may disagree, try not to impose my thinking and my, I try to me kind of example, you know, so I figured they know what I'm doing. They know what my beliefs are. I, you know, I communicate that in different ways. I don't have to hit them over the head with it and say, I think you should do this or that.
Right.
You know, so I think I've gained an appreciation of, looking back at my own life, how important it is for people really do have to learn from their own experiences. And I can remember so many times where I thought of something that someone did or said many years prior that was maybe in the back of my mind that made a difference at a later point, and it made me appreciate how, you know, you really are the sum total of the experiences and interactions and points of wisdom that other people give you. But you don't necessarily, it doesn't sink in or hit immediately.
Right.
You know, so I think I try to think about not trying to impose on people, but to let them observe, to offer.
Right. And it's hard being an activist type too. It's hard even to make an observation without it feeling like an imposition to people who've seen me work, because, you know, once I'm committed to something, I will see it through, and for better or worse sometimes. And sometimes it would be better if I just stopped and let it go.
Yeah.
So my kids have kind of seen that, and they're the 20 year old son, a 26 year old daughter, and the same kind of challenge. So, and I am having to discover as you're talking that that it's more about keeping the conversation going in unexpected ways and then letting it sit. There, I can be like a dog with a bone chewing on an issue and wanting to, you know, wanting to get it. And that that's sometimes helpful, but usually not when it comes to big stuff.
Yeah. And I think I in this conversation, I'm thinking I make a distinction between the family and the friends and the larger community that I'd like, you know, to really, that I'm interacting with, that I'd like to hopefully have develop better understandings with, and maybe bring some folks along to recognize some of the things that I think are important. But that's very different from, you know, I think I am a dog with a bone when I'm dealing with with adversaries. There's no question. Yeah. You know, when you're out in the public space and you're trying to, you know, as part of a community group or a labor union or some other group, trying to really address a wrong and right it, then I have no problem whatsoever being very assertive and very aggressive.
And what I'm trying to do, my perception, my analysis, mm-hmm. is that we have become too kid glovish mm-hmm. with our yeah. immediate relations, mm-hmm. and we've been too quick to go to too heavy artillery with our adversaries.
Okay.
And we need to probably, as a culture, learn how to be able to fight with dignity, mm-hmm. both within our families and outside. And if people mm-hmm. can see us working in both environments, then they won't be scared of us.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. being and trusting that it mm-hmm. will work out. I mean, without the nifty thing about growing up working at a store mm-hmm. Where I did, mm-hmm. I mean, there were people who were you know, in a small town, and I imagine the neighborhood in Newburgh may have been a little bit like this, people knew that even your worst enemy needed what it takes to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And if they didn't have it, everybody was going to be the worse for it.
Mm-hmm.
So we lack that kind of trust or generosity mm-hmm. towards others with whom we fundamentally mm-hmm. disagree.
Mm-hmm.
But we can come to work together, even if mm-hmm. we never agree about much,
mm-hmm.
but making sure that everybody has, in their own terms, what they need to
mm-hmm.
to thrive, or they know mm-hmm. why they can't,
mm-hmm.
because it's not fair to somebody else.
Right.
And our families have become a little soft, you know, mm-hmm. what I call soft in the head, not analytical enough. We can still love each other deeply, but it's hard sometimes to be mm-hmm. a force to be reckoned with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
I guess I'm just drawing a line, I guess, in terms of that arena of our lives.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the things I've been involved with are adversaries or people that have a lot of money and a lot of power, and they're just out there imposing their will. So, you know, you deal with that a bit differently. I think that's...
Yeah, and I guess you know, what I have found in terms of dealing with powerful adversaries, mm-hmm. when I'm friends with some of their family members and we become like family, then I have a whole different leverage.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I don't have to take the same, and I can push a person because I know the mm-hmm. Drug addiction of their adult child or the struggle that they've had around a mental illness or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and I can push in a way that has humanity behind it and mm-hmm. less force,
mm-hmm.
if you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean. And mm-hmm. if part of the reason for doing this show is so that we can learn to talk more openly mm-hmm. about our commitments mm-hmm. and our tactics sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So where it's mm-hmm. hard is, you know, rural folk are kind of like what the Israeli born people born in Israel are called sabras, mm-hmm. which means
mm-hmm.
cactuses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're prickly and they're hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. really rural, not small town folks, mm-hmm. but rural folks can be hard like that, but they're mm-hmm. also very tender and
mm-hmm.
and sensitive yes. inside, and learning how to be with each other
right.
in that way and not fear, you know, we right. have some real profound issues to face,
right?
And strengthening up is I don't mean to digress too much.
Yeah.
What keeps you? What keeps you in Cortland? What keeps you here in this area?
Well, actually, I think my answer to that is related a bit to what you just said. I think that, you know, we can focus on specific goals and things we want to work on and change, but the reality is that you know, trying to get people in a community to accept common things that are good and, uh-huh. and try to work depends on how we interact with them in other, you know, just
in other venues.
Yeah. And so one of the things I really like about the Cortland, I actually live in Homer, Ithaca area, is I just find it a wonderful place to live. I mean, a great place to raise children. A lot of people doing a lot of very basic things. Mm-hmm. You know, there are community groups you can get involved in, volunteer organizations, festivals, you know, celebrations that happen annually where you can get together with, whether it's the, you know, the typical Harvest Apple festivals
right,
or the
right,
Labor Day
right.
picnics, or, you know, there are so many things that we have available to us, I think, in this central New York community that just bring people together. in a very basic way. And I've seen a lot of really positive volunteerism, you know, where people come together, whether it's Habitat for Humanity or, you know, we have a new museum, relatively new museum complex in Cortland Homer, the Central New York Living History Center. Just hundreds of volunteers have been involved. And I just love that aspect. And I know that happens in other places too, but I've had the benefit of experiencing it here. So it's made me very, very happy to be a community member here.
Right. Right. And one of my friends down in Central Pennsylvania studies kind of activism, but it's across the decades. Mm-hmm. And what he found was that people who were active in opposing a nuclear power plant in Central Pennsylvania, they were active on that issue for maybe 5 or 10 years. They won. Mm-hmm. And then another issue came up having to do with nuclear waste or whatever. Mm-hmm. And other issues came have come up. And what happens is people have in their own energy, they have about 5 to 10 years on any issue, and then they want to move to something else. And if they're really connected, and that's and they may have less if they don't really connect. But what happens is that people would build up relational networks, and then the relational networks would be slightly different because the next issue would energize a different group of people. And eventually you would have people who had relationships who were enemies on certain issues. But because they had this background, they knew how to to talk to each other, to challenge each other with affirmation, I would say with love. And he would too, but he's a rare sociologist who uses the word love. Carl Milofsky, you may have heard of him. This is a very powerful thing that you're talking about, and you only get it when you invest decades in a place.
Yeah, and I think, too, it gets back to what we were talking about before. You do learn that, you know, when you're trying to build a relationship or work collaboratively with someone on a, in a particular community group or project, if there are things that you are really diametrically opposed over, you just may not want to go there at that point.
At that time.
Exactly.
That
you, you don't want to take them on in that other context, because that may just block the possibility of developing the relationship.
Right.
There may be a time a little bit later. You know, I mean, I think that's one thing that's been very productive for me to think about, too, that, you know, activism is built over many, 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 many years of, you know, if it's, and my mother often said, if it's not one cause, it's going to be another. There are so many things that we need to work on collectively. So, you know, relationships you build in one arena may 10 years down the road come to bring you together with people toward another goal, you know, working toward another goal.
No, it's hard for some of us who are on to issues very early and feel them, and they're absolutely clear to us. And when we run into the brick wall of others who have more power and have they don't see it, they don't want it. It's very hard to let it go.
That's been
one of my biggest challenges.
Yes,
I wanted to study faith, but faith understood as a discipline of trust and hope. Towards the future. How do you act on it with how do you hold each other accountable? How do you differ? How do you do all these sorts of things? But framing it as a matter of faith and not as a matter of political alliances, which is a very different sort of thing. 25 years ago, there were lots of very mature, very wise evangelicals who were not the stereotype of the judgmental, thumping, whatever, but they didn't make it into the popular discourse. But I happen to know a number of them, and I wanted to write about their work. But in the academy, that work was so alien that they couldn't believe it even existed, let alone analyze it on its own terms. And yet now Brené Brown is coming out with these videos on shame and guilt and trust and all this stuff. We're there. We're there. And that's, you know, 25 years later.
Interesting.
So it's just kind of funny how things move and migrate. And while we still have the popular caricature of the leftist and the right wing, you know, the leftist secularist and the right wing evangelical Christian, you know, there's not a lot of play, not a lot of muscle in those caricatures anymore.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges we have, is because even though those caricatures really, I think, are people don't see them as holding much weight, there are new characters that are developing. So I think that's a constant struggle to try. You know, again, I find most people who are opposed to people who are doing certain things don't understand them. They don't know them. They don't, you know, doesn't mean they would ever agree with them totally. But, you know, we don't often delve deeply into trying to understand why is someone taking the position they're taking or doing what they're doing, and how can we, how important is it for us to learn that before we can really try to move forward.
And you stay put in a place, you get to know people, you begin to chip away at, and caricatures are usually the shadow of our unquestioned dreams or our worst nightmares, where we really haven't critically thought them through or felt actually more accurately experienced them through. One of the issues with activism is that it tends to make us more cerebral and less experiential. That seems odd because activism is an act. But we're oftentimes driven by a cause that we've intellectualized. How do you balance that notion of a way of life with also a cause that needs to provoke change?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure I can really relate to that characterization, only because anything I've been involved in, it doesn't work because I'm just working my butt off with a lot of other people. And even if you don't accomplish the goal, it's the doing that does move you forward in some way or other.
It actually isn't mostly cerebral
for me.
I guess what gets cerebral oftentimes is, as you were saying before, the caricature of the enemy. And that's where it gets cerebral. Unless you find those ways to really be shoulder to shoulder, even when you're in intense conflict. So that's how I meant.
I guess I'd have to think about that.
Because there's solidarity often among the like-minded, but there could be solidarity with your enemy, which is something that we have a hard time thinking about. But experientially, we can get there even when we can't think our way there. That's what I was trying to say.
I think that's an excellent point. And it really does, those opportunities come the more you're actually out there, you know.
With each other.
Yeah. Yeah, even in what may appear to be adversarial circumstances, like, say, a town meeting or something over an issue where people who are on opposite sides of an issue come together, there are often opportunities in the context of that to interact differently.
And people play roles, like the Polish the general who shut down Solidarity. Many people read his action as a wink and a nod. He shut it down, but he did not kill anybody. And he made it possible for it to happen.
That's right.
Power completely within a few years. That kind of, you never know if your enemy is really your enemy or somebody who has to protect other things that are much more complex.
Yes. And I think related to that too, things build over time where you may think you have been unsuccessful. On something, but you know, there is something to be said for timing and other factors converging maybe to create the space
or the tipping point, our time is running out, and I want to get to this question. What do you do to when things get you down, when life is kind of when it's not going well, what do you do to restore your sense of balance emotionally, intellectually, and physically? How do you take care of yourself?
Well, I think I'll start with the physically, and I need to get better at this, especially as I'm getting older. I know the importance of exercise and good physical wellness actions are very important. I love to work around my house. I love to work in the yard. I think lately that's been, especially now that we're into nice weather, just pulling weeds is therapeutic for me sometimes when I feel really stressed.
The repetitive motion.
Yes. And,
you know,
and
all
doing,
you have to do is identify the weed.
Growing things, because when we're largely, given the work that I do, you're largely engaged in work that doesn't have a tangible physical product. I find that it's very important to do that. I love to cook. I love, you know, so I think my way of regaining balance is to just go back to the basic things that I do in the context of my family, right. You know, around things, projects around the house, outdoors.
And the sometimes home and it's, garden, productive
yeah,
labor.
And sometimes that's doing it with others, you know, helping helping somebody else move into a house right. or do something like that. So I really like to do that. I think when I get down about the work that I'm doing and not seeing results, those feelings are very short lived for me. Mm-hmm. There are certainly times where I feel it's hopeless, mm-hmm. but that doesn't stay with me
what
long.
What do you do when they come? How do you recognize that they've come, and what do you do?
Well, because usually I think when it comes to me, it's my own inner feeling of hopelessness, and I feel like I'm beating my head against the wall. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things. Then I call somebody who is. Or maybe more than one person who's working on something with me and get their energy. You know, you get another perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that one of the things that keeps me highly motivated, and this has been true probably in any work that I've done or activism that I've done, is the relationships that you build with the people who are also committed, or the people that you're working for and with. Mm-hmm. That's true certainly with the union work, that I'm doing currently. That is the greatest value is coming from the solidarity. That it's cliche, but it's true.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
you know, when
sure.
you're working side by side with people who share the same concerns or similar concerns,
right, right.
Who really want to make positive change, and there's an energy that that kind of permeates from that. So I just look to the other people, and they may not even know it. If I'm feeling down, I need to call so-and-so. I need to have a conversation about what's our next move,
because
talking about our next steps or our next work, actions, or whatever we're doing just gets me out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Puts me back in the practical. There's a job to be done.
You get reoriented by your relationship with somebody you trust.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Neat.
Yeah, I think so. Or sometimes it's just talking to my family, my husband, or...
Do you do anything by yourself?
Well, when I'm out there pulling weeds...
Right, I was thinking that didn't come to mind.
Yeah.
Some people read or sing or whatever.
Actually, I've had less time to read than I'd like, to read for pleasure, because mm-hmm. I read so much related to my work.
Right,
so
sure.
At this phase in my life, I've had less time for reading, I think. You know, that's changed over time. It depends
on...
And
it may change again.
And that may change again. But probably I don't do a lot by myself, other than the fact that some of the things I already mentioned, even cooking, and I love to cook, that's kind of solitary.
Activity.
But it results in a communal
thing. Yeah.
But I that's pretty much do right. the cooking myself.
You go into yourself
yes.
and you bring it out.
And then you bring it out.
Yeah,
and
I
think that's all I need.
And that's gardening is like that, too.
Yeah.
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 Jamie, it's been really
yeah.
good to get to know you.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And
again,
shall we end with Forever Young or Desperado? Which would you
How about
like
Forever
to?
Young?
Okay. I think this captures the spirit
yes.
of your activism in your life.
Thank you very much.
May God bless and keep you always. May your wishes all come true. May you always do for others and let others do for you. May you build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung, and may you stay.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen. And that concludes the Made of Clay report.